Good morning, it's Chelsea here reading the BBC News, and we're starting out with live email by A from Balmoral asked Maxwell, Ghislaine Maxwell, for Inappropriate Friends Epstein Files show. The emails do not indicate any wrongdoing. The BBC has contacted Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's team for a response. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor has repeatedly denied all wrongdoing. He lost use of his Duke of York title following scrutiny over his links with Epstein. Elsewhere, Donald Trump was listed as a passenger on Epstein's private jet on 8 flights between 1993 and 1996. Trump has consistently denied wrongdoing in relation to Epstein, and his alleged presence on the flights does not indicate wrongdoing. Both emails appear in the largest batch so far of the Epstein files. The documents it holds relating to the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. DOJ says some files contain untrue Trump claims. The Justice Department says that some of these documents contain untrue and sensationalized claims made against President Trump that were submitted to the FBI right before the 2020 election, and a statement published following this latest file drop. Going back on this, the investigation into Epstein was really, it reached a plea deal with prosecutors in 2008 after the parents of a 14-year-old girl told police in Florida that Epstein had molested their daughter. Photos of girls were found throughout the house, and he was convicted of soliciting prostitution from a minor. He escaped from a heavy jail sentence as a result of the ordeal. 11 years later, he was charged with running a network of underage girls for sex. He died in prison in 2019 while awaiting trial, and his death was ruled a suicide. Why are the files being released now? Pressure has been building for months from across the political spectrum for more transparency into the investigations. After initially resisting calls for the files' release, U.S. President Donald Trump reversed course and urged Republicans to support disclosure of the records. Congress then passed the Epstein Files Transparency Act, which required the Justice Department to release all its investigative material related to Epstein by the end of day on 19th of December. Partial release of the Epstein Files, a large collection of documents, including court and telephone records and thousands of images, was uploaded on Friday night to the U.S. Department of Justice website. It's the result of two criminal investigations culminating in the so-called Epstein files. It was only the partial release of the Justice Department's documents, and many pages were heavily redacted, with some blocked out in full. This sparked criticism from victims and lawmakers alike. The White House says the Trump administration is the most transparent in history, and the Justice Department says the omissions are necessary to protect victims and for continuing investigations. Who was pictured in the files released last week? Apparently, Rolling Stones frontman Mick Jagger and former U.S. President Bill Clinton were pictured together in the files released over the weekend. These were the several notable figures. U.S. Justice Department has not provided any context for the images, making it difficult to piece together when or where they were taken. Being pictured in the files is not an indication of any wrongdoing. Many of those identified have denied wrongdoing in relation to Epstein. Here's a roundup of the famous faces you've seen. Well, we've seen here Richard Branson, Virgin founder, Jean-Luc Brunel, French modeling agent, Bill Clinton, former U.S. president, Walter Cronkite, U.S. broadcaster, Mick Jagger, musician, and Michael Jackson, musician. And Diana Ross, musician, Kevin Spacey, actor, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, former British prince, P. Peter Mandelson, British politician, and Ghislaine Maxwell, convicted Epstein associate. Images of Epstein's passport are among the latest batch of files. Within this latest release, which includes more than 11,000 files, are images of an old United States passport belonging to Jeffrey Epstein. It was issued in February 1985 and expired in 1985 and expired in 1995. Below his signature is black and white passport photo of Epstein dressed in a suit and tie. In Friday's batch of material, we saw another one of Epstein's passport issued in March 2009, it's a US, also a USA passport. Our teams are looking through the material that's just dropped. When it comes to images, the first thing we do is check if they previously appeared online via a reverse image search. If there are people featured in the images who we don't recognize, we'll use public available facial recognition tools, but they aren't always reliable, so we might need further corroboration. We're also combining through the text documents and any video, or bring you details of this as it is shared. More materials arrives, but will it satisfy the clamor for information? Donald Trump has repeatedly said the ongoing conversation around Epstein is distracting from his work as U.S. president. It's a point he reiterated to reports yesterday at his home in Mar-a-Lago, Florida. But the pressure on the administration to release all the files that it has on Epstein, the late convicted sex offender, is not going away. Information release by the DOJ as far has been criticized by campaigners in Washington and beyond over the amount of material that was withheld, as said earlier, or redacted. The Justice Department, led by Bondi, insisted it is complying with its legal obligations to both publish the information that it holds about Epstein while also protecting his victims. As Friday came and went, it promised that more files would be made public. Some of the additional files have now landed. On Monday, Donald Trump made his first comments on the so-called Epstein files, the publication of an initial tranche on Friday. He dismissed the intense speculation over what was and wasn't included and distracting from his party's achievements. President Trump has scarcely been mentioned in the previous batches of released. Former U.S. President Clinton has featured prominently in some of the photos shared. Asked for his reaction, Trump said, "I like Bill Clinton. I hate to see photos come out of him. There's photos of me, too. Everybody was friendly with this guy, Epstein." You probably have pictures being exposed of other people that innocently met Jeffrey Epstein years ago, many years ago, and they're highly respected bankers and lawyers and others. And they're in a picture with him because he was at a party, and you ruin a reputation of somebody. The U.S. president has consistently denied any wrongdoing in relation to Epstein. Previously, Trump said he was a friend of Epstein for years, but said they fell out in 2004, years before Epstein was first arrested. The royal Christmas cards have a touchy, feely look this year. Maybe there was a memo sent round to the royal households of Europe, but many of this year's Christmas cards seem to have similar images of showing their families holding on to each other tenderly, touching, linking arms, holding hands, hugging. They're all sending message about how close they are to each other. It's like royal superglue has been applied, connecting them in these Christmas portraits. This is an era of relatable royals. The Prince and Princess of Wales have been leading the way with a Christmas card showing a relaxed, informal family group cozying up to each other in the Norfolk countryside. As with last year's card, they're continuing in a style that is far away from a stiff formal portrait showing a young family having fun together on a spring day, full of affection, dressed in jeans and jumpers. Prince William has talked about making changes as an approach to the monarchy. And this is the projecting an image that they're like any other family with eyelines, not looking down on the viewer, literally down to earth, sitting on the grass. Compare that to the 1969 Christmas card, which shows the royals laughing, smiling, and gathered around a boat. Presumably, this was meant to feel relaxed and modern. But they're fairly stiffly dressed. They're all standing apart, and it looks like they've just been presented a prize on a game show. Back to 2025, the King Charles and Queen Camilla are arm in arm in their Christmas card, a show of unity in what's been a busy year. The picture is a mix of the friendly and the formal. Taken on the first day of the state visit to Italy when the couple was celebrating their 20th anniversary. The Queen is wearing a Lily of the Valley brooch, a symbol of enduring love. That trip was in April, which accounts for the spring backdrop for this Christmas card. The setting is Villa Volkonski. In Rome, the elegant residence of the UK is ambassador to Italy. And next up, for the royals, is the Happy Holiday. Prince Harry and Meghan are holding hands in the Christmas card, or in fact, a Happy Holiday season card. Unlike others, they've got the season right, with some festive snow captured in a picture from the Invictus game in Canada in February. They look like a fashionable couple smiling optimistically from behind their sunglasses. It's got a sense of movement. Although the framing of the message isn't so intimate, on behalf of the office of Prince Harry and Meghan, Duke and Duchess of Sussex. The portrait of the Belgium royal family shows them as though on the way to some grand event, or at least waiting at a very upmarket bus stop. They've gone for a more polished look, suits, ties, long dresses, but also with a bit of greenery. The picture was presumably taken when it was warmer outside their residence at the Palace of Laeken. It's a multilingual country, and the greeting inside is Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year is in French, German, Flemish, and English. The Spanish royals combined a range of styles with their Christmas card. It's projecting a casual, approachable family image, as if catching them accidentally on a walk in the countryside. No more ties or tiaras for these modern royals. But at the same time, it has all the dynastic shape of a traditional court painting. A monarch and his family are looking out at us. It's Velasquez in jeans. The setting, a place which won an award for the best village in the Asturias region, sends a message about supporting Spain's small communities and their traditional heritage. King Felipe is 6'6" tall, so presumably the family group had to be arranged so that he didn't tower over them. For Spaniards, it's a case of a very long it's a case of very long to reign over us. Monaco's royal Christmas card is much grander, with a big fire, oil painting, formal clothes, and a sense of regal order. There's also a sighting of Alan Partridge style, smart, casual look. Bonus points, though, for actually showing a bit of Christmas and a tree in the log fire, unlike many of the other cards, which are basically just people sending out pictures of themselves. Another extra detail is the tiny dog smuggled into the picture. Besides Charlene, a princess of Monaco, she's a former Olympic swimmer, so not shy about making a splash. The Luxembourg royals, the Grand Duke Guillaume and the Grand Duchess Stephanie, have covered all the angles for a 2025 card. It's got that touchy-feely, we're-not-uptight family atmosphere, full of playful laughs and children clambering over their parents. It's also got a proper tree with decorations. There's a Rudolph reindeer toy, and they've put some thought into all the splashes of red. It might look a bit chaotic, but it's Christmassy. But there was no contest. This year's winner, Juan Carlos, who abdicated as Spanish king in 2014, hit by scandals, now living in Abu Dhabi, sent an irresistible royal Christmas card. Five small dogs in front of an artificial tree, looking regal in a kind of classy royal portrait lineup. But it's more bark than buck. What does it mean? The light is glinting on the dog's baubles. They look up with crumpled, hopeful faces. It's Christmas, and that's a time for pause and a pause for thought. Next up from the BBC, volunteer who's 81 left speechless by royal invite. And we can't seem to load this. One moment. An admirable 81-year-old volunteer said she was speechless when asked to attend the Princess of Wales annual Christmas Carol concert at Westminster Abbey. Anne Davies, who was dedicated a decade to cooking for and supporting vulnerable people at the Moses Project in Stockton-on-Tees, was among royals, celebrities and other local heroes to be invited to the event on 5th of December. Mrs. Davies said, "We saw William and Kate and their three kids. The atmosphere inside the Abbey was fantastic. The Moses Project provides guidance, mentoring and support to hundreds of adult males with past and current addictions to drugs and alcohol. A grandmother of three also volunteers as a responsible adult at the Middlesbrough police station, supporting vulnerable people who have been arrested." Stella Jones, 70, operations manager at the Moses Project, said after the charity received two tickets for the event, Mrs. Davies was one of the volunteers chosen to attend because she has a heart of the people she cooks for. Someone who is 81 and still given to society and showing compassion and caring is admirable. We think a lot of her, she said. On the front row, "I couldn't believe it. I was speechless," said Mrs. Davies on receiving her invite. "The atmosphere at Westminster Abbey was amazing," she said. "We were on the front row, so of course Catherine was coming up and down talking to children near the front, and she stopped about two places along from me. In a festive abbey dotted with Christmas trees, the 1,600 guests heard a mix of traditional carols, music, poems from actors such as Kate Winslet and Chiwetel Ejiofor, and Bible reading by Prince William." And they even have a picture taken of her out there. Mrs. Davies has been supporting a group of vulnerable women in the area before getting involved with the project. She said, "We're the only family these men have in some cases. It's a trust that we've built up. It really is lovely. I'm known as Granny. The former Score catering manager said, we've had a few laughs, we've had a few tears over the years, and they have got trapped. And they have got trapped in that lifestyle. Mrs. Davies cooks for about 50 men and continues to support and continues her support for them in police custody if they are arrested. She vowed, there's no way I'm quitting, you know, while I'm standing. And that was, again, the BBC. And there might be a little more here on the story. Catherine joined by stars and charity heroes for Christmas Carol concert. The Princess of Wales has hosted her annual Christmas Carol concert at Westminster Abbey, with guests including royal celebrities and local heroes who have helped their communities. In a festive abbey dotted with Christmas trees, the 1,600 guests heard a mixture of traditional carols, music, poems from actors, as previously mentioned, such as Kate Winslet and Chiwetel Ejiofor, and the Bible reading from the pulpit by Prince William. Next up, screams for help and panic as tourists rescued from fatal Laos ferry disaster. This is about 3 hours ago that this happened in, this is Bangkok. It was supposed to be just another Thursday in Laos where Antonin's father was born. Instead, the 30-year-old French citizen found himself among more than 140 people, mostly tourists, on a ferry that capsized in the Mekong River. All but three are thought to have made it to safety. Videos online show a scene of chaos, people screaming for help, children crying, and passengers scrambling to get their belongings. Antonin, who declined to give his full name, recalls seeing a mother and two children on board the ferry, but they were nowhere to be seen on the rescue boat. On Monday, Lao media reported that the body of a woman named Pani Hare had been retrieved from the river. Rescuers then found the body of a one-year-old who they believe was one of the children. Efforts to find a second child are continuing. Only 15 life jackets. The boat was making its way last Thursday from the riverside town of Hue Zay to the historic city of Luang Prabang in northern Laos. A common route along the Mekong and popular with visitors to the country. There were 118 tourists and 29 locals, including four crew, on board the boat when it struck underwater rocks near the Tam Ting Pakau caves, according to an official report carried by Laotian Times. Within minutes, the ferry began to sink. The crew were just totally unprepared for that. There was a lot of confusion. It happened really, really fast. Antonin said, what was, you know, puzzling and alarming is that there were very few life jackets, around like 15 life jackets maximum. It was really bad. As the boat continued to capsize, passengers shouted to a passing boat for help, but it did not stop, possibly because, according to him, it was relatively small. The second one, however, did stop and take them in. However, according to British tourist Bradley Cook, another passenger on board, that briefly made it worse. The 27-year-old told the BBC that as the rescue boat came closer to their ferry, people started to shift and put weight on one side of the ferry, causing water to fill up the hull even quicker. Mr. Cook went to the other side to climb on the roof from where he jumped onto the rescue ferry. Some people managed to climb over to the ferry while others swam for it, hung onto the rails and got pulled up by others. Both Antonin and Mr. Cook were among those rescued, but others were less fortunate. Antonin says he was helping some other passengers receive their luggage at the back of the sinking ferry when he saw a Lao mother and her two children. However, when he was on the rescue ferry, he realized they weren't there. Some people were crying, panicking. It was a mess, he said. But I didn't fear for my life. I was more affected by the three missing people. Lao media later reported that the body of the Lao woman, Pani Hare, and one-year-old child was found separately near Loang Prabang, Thailand. Another passenger, Gabrielis Baranovikas, 19, told the BBC that he and his friend, both of whom are from Lithuania, did not panic at first. We were just joking around, adding that his attitude quickly changed when he realized they were sinking. After getting on the rescue boat, he said he started filming what was happening on board. But when I heard other people screaming, I turned off the camera and went straight to help other people in the water to get on the boat. Tens of thousands of tourists use slow boat and speedboat services every year along the 185-mile route connecting the Wei Zay, Pakbeng, and Luang Prabang, according to the Mekong River Commission. For Mr. Cook, the experience was terrifying, and it made him want to get out of Luang Prabang, although everyone's really friendly here because it was a constant reminder of his narrow escape. Speaking to the BBC from Vang Vieng, a town in northern Laos, Mr. Cook said he planned to file for insurance claims for electrical items that were broken and for cash that was lost, though he was not sure who would be held responsible. I'm assuming it's just a freak accident, he said, though he added, was not sure how avoidable the ferry capsizing was. It's not the first time such a sinking has happened in Laos. In September 2023, a passenger boat which travelled on the same river corridor between Hun Zai and Luang Prabang capsized in the Mekong in Pakbeng district, resulting in three deaths. The boat reportedly became entangled in a fishing net, causing loss of control and the vessel overturning in strong currents. Related to the article, Laos poisoning survivor calls for methanol awareness. A British man who went blind during a mass poisoning in Laos that killed six other backpackers had said he would still have his sight if he had been aware of the dangers. Cullen MacDonald, 23, from Sunbury on Thames, Surrey, in England, joined bereaved families to meet members of the travel industry in Parliament on Monday. Campaigners want the government and travel industry to raise greater awareness of the dangers of methanol poisoning by introducing specific posters and in-flight announcements. The Foreign Office, which attended the meeting and was tackling the issue head-on, working with local authorities and over 150 travel industry partners on its Travel Aware campaign. I think it's important that people know, obviously, because it's quite a simple bit of information you can get that can really save you a lot of pain, Mr. MacDonald said. I certainly think I'd been aware of the risks. I wouldn't have been here today without my vision. Mr. MacDonald had been backpacking in Laos when he fell victim to a mass methanol poisoning in Vang Vieng. In the hospital in Vietnam, I was there for 2 or 3 weeks, and at that point, my vision was totally black, he said. I was thinking I'll be fine for the first week. It wasn't really until probably January or February, I think, when I found out that it was going to be really sort of a permanent or long-term thing. Fellow traveller Simone White, 28-year-old lawyer from Orpington, died in 2024 along with five others after consuming free shots at the same hostel as Mr. McDonald in Laos. The campaigner Amanda Dennis, who represents Miss White's family, said, "All these youngsters have died unnecessarily, and it could have been so easy avoided if there had been more awareness, if there had been some knowledge, and if they'd had it taught in schools." The government said it had updated the curriculum on increasing personal safety while drinking alcohol, including how to avoid poisoning from potentially fatal substances such as methanol. The ABTA Travel Association, which also attended the meeting, said that it welcomed the opportunity to speak to affected family members and campaigners. "We have committed to sharing Travel Aware campaign details with our members, exploring how we may be able to utilize our education partners and student representatives to amplify messaging and continuing to engage with the round table group and update them on our activities," a spokesman said. A Foreign Office spokesperson said, "We are tackling this issue head on, working with local authorities and 150 travel industry partners to promote our Travel Aware campaign, raise awareness of the dangers and help British travellers stay safe abroad." It published a new guidance on Monday in highlight the signs of methanol poisoning. Apparently, it only takes a small amount of methanol to rapidly cause serious illnesses. Visual impairments ranging from sensitivity to light to blindness can develop after ingestion. If you suspect methanol poisoning, seek urgent help. Interesting article about 5 hours ago. This is our future. Climate advisor warns as 2025 to break heat records. Rising temperatures in the UK will become the new normal, a leading government climate advisor has warned as she calls for more to be done to prepare for the impacts of climate change. It comes as the Met Office revealed 2025 was on course to be the UK's hottest year since records began, with climate change continuing to drive higher temperatures. With just over a week to go, the average UK air temperature across 2025 is on track to end up being 10.05 centigrade, which would edge out the record of 10.03 centigrade from 2022. "This is our future encapsulated in data," Professor Rachel Kite told the BBC. "Now the question is, how are we going to prepare ourselves and build our resilience to this? A lack of rainfall and persistent warmth left the country vulnerable to droughts and wildfires through the spring and summer. While temperatures vary naturally from year to year, scientists could not be clearer that human-caused climate change is driving the UK's rapidly warming trend. The pollution, carbon dioxide, we've put in for the last 20 to 30 years is now what is driving this warmth, and so not curbing emissions well enough means we're going to continue to see these kinds of impacts," Professor Kite, the UK's special representative for climate, said. She said the UK needed to become more resilient to the inevitability of higher temperatures through future investment in nature and infrastructure. If we don't invest in our adaptation now, it's going to cost us more, way more, she warned. By the end of 2025, the UK's 10 warmest years on record will UK's 10 warmest years on record will all have taken place in the last two decades in measurements going back to the late 1800s. Human-caused climate change is causing the warming in the UK as it's causing the warming across the world, said Amy Doherty, a climate scientist at the Met Office. What you have seen in the past 40 years and what we're going to continue to see is more records broken, more extremely hot years. So what was normal 10 years ago, 20 years ago, will become relatively cool in the future, she told BBC News. The Met Office's projection uses observed temperatures up to 21 December and assumes that the remaining days of the year are 2 centigrades below the long-term December average, with slightly cooler conditions expected over Christmas. So while the Met Office cannot say with certainty that 2025 will be the hottest year, it is most likely the outcome. It will be the sixth time this century that the UK has set a new annual temperature record, following 2002, 2003, 2006, 2014, and 2022. The changes we are seeing are unprecedented in observational records back to the 19th century, and Mike Kendon, another climate scientist at the Met Office. The expected new record of 2025 has been built on persistent heat through the spring and summer. Those long, hot, sunny days may feel like a distant memory as we head towards Christmas, but both the spring and summer were the UK's warmest ever recorded. Each month, from March to August, was more than 2 centigrades above the long-term average between 1961 and 1990. Temperatures peaked at 35.8 centigrade, well below the highs of more than 40 centigrade seen in July 2022. But hot spells happened repeatedly. Four separate, albeit relatively short-lived heat waves were declared across much of the country. The UK Health Security Agency was issued several heat health alerts through the summer. Mr. Kendon said longer spells of hotter days and nights pose an increased risk to elderly and vulnerable people. He told the Today program it would have an impact on the agriculture sectors, influencing which crops farmers are able to grow in the UK. Area burned by UK wildfires in 2025 already at annual record. The area of the UK burnt by wildfires so far this year is already higher than the total for any year in more than a decade, satellite data suggests. More than 29,200 hectares, which is 292 square kilometres or 113 square miles, has been burnt so far, according to figures from the Global Wildfire Information System, which has recorded burnt area since 2012. That is more than the previous high of 28,100 hectares for the whole year of 2019. The prolonged dry, sunny weather in March and early April helped to create ideal conditions for widespread burning, according to researchers. Wildfires are very common in the UK in early spring, with a plenty of dead or dormant vegetation at the end of winter that can dry out quickly. The switchback to wetter conditions over the past couple of weeks has largely brought an end to the spell of fires for now, but not before reaching higher levels. The figures from the Global Wildfire Information System only capture fires larger than roughly 30 hectares. More than 80 such fires have been detected across the UK since the beginning of the year. Most fires are deliberately or accidentally started by humans. But favourable weather conditions can make it much easier for fires to ignite and spread quickly. We had an exceptionally dry and sunny March, said Will Lang, head of risk and resilience services at the Met Office. This followed quite a wet autumn and winter, which can have the effect of increasing the vegetation that acts as fuel for any fire that does start. The lack of rainfall in March and April can be particularly conducive to fires. Vegetation is coming out of the winter and has gone dormant, so it's not growing, and therefore it's very dry and doesn't have water, explained the Professor of Fire Science at Imperial College London. That's Guillaume Rain. Then in the spring, before you start to collect the water into the live tissue, there is a period where it's very flammable. The 7 days from 2nd to the 8th of April saw more than 18,000 hectares burnt, the highest weekly figure on record. The BBC has also analysed satellite images to illustrate two of the biggest burns this year. In Galloway Forest Park in southwest Scotland, an estimated 65 square kilometres burnt, nearly a quarter of the UK total. A fire in Mid Wales, about 25 kilometres or 60 miles from Aberystwyth, also burnt a large area of roughly 50 square kilometres. Fires have also been detected by satellite imagery on the Isle of Arran, the Isle of Bute, and the Isle of Skye in Scotland, as well as the Mourne Mountains in southeast Northern Ireland, all occurred in early April. These early season burns, predominantly grass, heath and scrub fires, have created great strain on fire services, but their ecological impacts can be complicated. Not all fires, particularly smaller, lower-intensity burns, are necessarily catastrophic to long-term vegetation health. Certain plants, such as heather, are adapted to fire-prone environments, but increasingly frequent or severe blazes can impair their ability to naturally recover. Some researchers are concerned about the second peak of the fire season, which typically comes later in the year, when temperatures are high and vegetation has dried out again. My number one worry is what is going to happen in the summer, said Professor Rain, when there are fewer wildfires, but they are bigger and they can actually be seriously catastrophic. You can have 100 small wildfires across the whole country and all of them can be handled in one day, or you can have one summer wildfire that actually cannot be stopped in a week and actually goes on to burn houses. The recent widespread burns don't necessarily mean this summer will be a busy fire season, but scientists expect the UK to see an increase in weather conditions conducive to extreme wildfires in a warming world, even though there's lots of variation from year to year. A study led by the Met Office found that the extreme fire weather that helped spread the destructive blazes of July 2022 were made at least six times more likely by human-caused climate change. Shifts in the way land is used can also play a key role in shaping fire risk. One thing that seems to have consensus is that we are likely to see more fires and possibly worse fires with climate change, said Harry Haddon, senior lecturer in fire investigation at the University of Edinburgh. We need to be prepared for this to become more common.
Our next article for today is entitled "The Year of the Octopus, Declared After Warmer Seas Lead to Record UK Numbers," written by Jonah Fisher. A wildlife charity has declared 2025 the Year of the Blooming Octopus after record numbers were spotted off the southwest coast of England. In its annual maritime review, the Wildlife Trusts says octopus numbers were this summer at their highest level since 1950. Warmer winters, which are linked to climate change, are thought to be responsible for the population spike, which is known as a quote-unquote bloom. The charity's findings are backed up by official figures, which show that more than 1,200 tons of octopus were caught by fishermen in UK waters in the summer of 2025. It's a dramatic increase on previous years. Only once since 2021 has more than 200 tons of octopus been landed. Experts say most of those spotted are Octopus vulgaris, a species commonly seen in the warmer Mediterranean Sea. Wildlife Trust's volunteers in Cornwall and Devon reported an increase in sightings of more than 1,500% on 2023 figures along one stretch of the south coast. "It really has been exceptional," says Matt Slater from the Cornwall Wildlife Trust. "We've seen octopuses jet-propelling themselves along. We've seen octopuses camouflaging themselves. They look just like seaweeds. We've seen them cleaning themselves. We've even seen them walking, using two legs just to nonchalantly cruise away from the diver underwater." It's unclear at this point whether the rise in numbers is permanent or cyclical, which could mean octopus numbers returning to more typical levels after this year's bloom. The eight-armed cephalopods eat shellfish such as lobster, crabs, and scallops, so the Wildlife Trusts warn that if population numbers remain high, both fishing and eating habits may have to change. They are having an impact on those shellfish species around our shores, and as a consequence, they will be having an impact on our fishing industry, who target those species as well, Ruth Williams, the head of Marine for the Wildlife Trusts, told the BBC's Today program. "But there are opportunities, and our fishing industry are doing some research into that at the moment, to try and evolve with the changing fisheries that we're seeing as a result of climate change." Government data shows crab landings down on previous years, but catches of lobster, crawfish, and scallops are stable. Alongside good news for octopus lovers, the Wildlife Trust's Marine Review contains more sobering news. The trusts say this year was bookended by environmental disasters, with a collision between an oil tanker and a container ship in the North Sea in March, spilling huge quantities of plastic resin pellets and nearly 4.5 tons of biobeads released from a water treatment plant in Sussex in November. There was some better news for wildlife elsewhere, with a record 46,000 puffins recorded on Scomer, Pembrokeshire, while the charismatic black and white bird has made a comeback on the Isle of Muck following conservation efforts by Ulster Wildlife Trust to remove invasive brown rats. Let's move right into the article on the puffins. entitled Puffin's Return to Island for First Time in at Least 25 Years, written by Louise Cullen. Puffins have been seen on the Isle of Muck in County Antrim for the first time in years after a major scheme to remove invasive brown rats. It is the first time the vulnerable seabird has been recorded on the tiny island off Island McGee since Ulster Wildlife took over the management of the seabird sanctuary 25 years ago. A program of rat eradication began in 2017, and winter grazing has now been implemented to keep vegetation low, so predator cover is reduced. The charity's Nature Reserves manager, Andy Crory, said the discovery of the puffins proves seabird restoration works. Five puffins were spotted in 2024. Then in spring this year, cameras set up as part of the rat eradication program caught two puffins coming and going from a nesting burrow on the cliff ledges. Their behavior, bringing food back to the nest, was a positive sign that they were breeding. For Mr. McCrory, tales of puffins once breeding on the Isle of Muck felt more like folklore, but the myth is now becoming a reality. Seabirds face immense challenges globally, with 24 of the 25 breeding species at risk of local or global extinction, he said. So while a handful of puffins on a tiny island may seem small, this moment is huge. It proves that seabird restoration works. Hope for pufflings next year. The puffin sightings are the latest in a long line of positive signs of the impact conservation management has been having on the island. Annual surveys have begun to record steady increases in eider ducks, guillemots, herring gulls, and lesser-backed gulls on and around the island year on year. It is not known for certain that the puffin seen this year managed to successfully rear a chick. But Mr. Crory is staying positive. Our hope is that the Isle of Muck will become a thriving stronghold for puffins, and in time, tempt back other lost species like the Manx shearwater. For now, we're waiting with great excitement to see if the first pufflings, baby puffins, appear on the cliffs next summer. That would truly be icing on the cake. Puffins are a priority species in Northern Ireland, and red-listed in the UK, putting them in the highest conservation concern bracket due to food shortages, climate change, and predation by invasive species. They spend most of their lives at sea, only returning to land to breed in spring and summer at the same nesting site with the same partner year after year. Each pair raises a single chick during the breeding season. Ulster Wildlife said rats are a major issue for many seabird islands across the UK, posing a threat to eggs and chicks. The Isle of Muck is not accessible to the public, and it is hoped that isolation will help the birds to return safely next summer. Other conservation successes, similar rat removal projects have been carried out elsewhere to help seabirds bounce back. The LIFE raft project on Rathlin Island is expected to have rid the island of the predators when it publishes its latest report soon. Ferrets have already been cleared from Rathlin in a world first project. Our last article for today is entitled Underweight Seal Pup Recovering After Beach Rescue by Ross Tappenden. An underweight and struggling seal pup rescued from a litter-strewn beach after Storm Bram is recovering very well, rescuers have said. the juvenile seal was spotted covered in mud and surrounded by debris near Seatown, Dorset on 9 December. A member of the public alerted British Divers Marine Life Rescue, which rescued the animal and is now being cared for by the RSPCA at Wet Hatch, Somerset. Rescuers have named it Nirvana and say that the male gray seal will eventually be released back into the world. He was underweight at 13.9 kilograms or 30.6 pounds, covered in mud and very dehydrated, so had clearly begun struggling alone for a while. We are grateful to members of the public that raised the alarm so the seal could be given the care he needs. West Hatch Rescue Center is currently caring for 44 seals. Three gray seals that arrived in September were released together on December 11. Well, that's all the time we have today for the BBC World News. My name is Vicki here at the Talking Information Center. Today is Tuesday, December 23rd, and we thank you so much for your time and for listening. Have a fantastic day.